The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
And good morning and welcome to this March 27th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org, always available via podcast. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, all things writerly. This is a virtual MFA program coming to you from the very best writers on the planet every week, always free. Direct to your iPhone. You can find us on iTunes under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook. You can have a look at our websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Lisa Gornick. And in the second half, Julie Clark will join me to chat about her debut novel, The Ones We Choose. Lisa Gornick has been hailed by NPR as one of the most perceptive, compassionate writers of fiction in America, immensely talented and brave. She is the author of the novels The Peacock Feast, Louisa Meets Bear, and Tinderbox, all published by FSG and Picador, as well as A Private Sorcery published by Algonquin. Her stories and essays have appeared in Agni, The New York Times, Prairie Schooner, Salon, Slate, and Real Simple. They have received many honors, including The Distinguished Story by American Best Short Stories. Lisa earned a doctorate in clinical psychology at Yale and is a graduate of the writing program at NYU and the psychoanalytic training program at Columbia, where she is on the faculty. For many years, she worked in clinics, hospitals, and private practice as a psychotherapist, a profession she has depicted in various essays as based on sacred trust. Lisa was on the show with me in 2015 chatting about Louisa Meets Bear. You can find a copy of that podcast in our archives. The book we're talking about this morning is The Peacock Feast. It came out last month and is widely available all over the place. Lisa, welcome back.
Thank you, Marie. I'm delighted to be back, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Oh, so I was relieved to hear this book wasn't simply the 3 or 4 years in the making since we last chatted, but it has been a work in progress for a long time, because it's not terribly long in pages, but when you read it, it feels so incredibly ambitious and like just this enormous undertaking. So we're going to dive into all of that and how and when and all of that started. But I will just congratulations on this really rich and complicated novel. So for listeners new to the book who haven't yet picked it up, why don't you, I'll let you kind of set the stage and take us inside the Peacock Feast and kind of give us the scope of this world.
Sure. Well, you're right. The Peacock Feast was a long time germinating, and I was finishing my last novel and then my collection of linked stories, some of which people have also called a novel, while I was in the early research stages. But the book is essentially structured like a braid with three strands, each of which are told chronologically, and then they ultimately plate together to form a kind of unitary story. And how they plate together is part of the sort of mystery of the stories. The first strand, which serves as a frame, is a series of meetings that takes place over a week in 2013 between Prudence, who's 101 years old, and born to a gardener and a maid on this fantastical Long Island estate of the glass genius Louis C. Tiffany, and Grace, her 43-year-old great-niece, who she's not even known existed before, because Prudence lost touch with her brother many, many years before when they were both quite young. So this strand, that first strand, is this series of encounters that takes place between the two of them over a week. The second strand is Prudence's story, which stretches, because she's 101 years old, over a century, and it begins with her earliest memory from the age of 2, and she's crouching behind a balustrade with another child, watching these girls in Grecian togas parading across a terrace with silver salvers hoisted on their slender shoulders, atop of which sit these roasted peacocks with their plumages reattached. And later on, when she becomes an interior designer and does some research herself on country homes, she discovers that this memory was from a quite famous party that Louis C. Tiffany threw in 1914 called the Peacock Feast. It was almost like a piece of performance art. And he had invited, quote, 150 men of genius that he brought on a train, a private train, out to his estate. And the story of Prudence, we're still in this second strand, moves forward through her life. Her family leaves the estate under circumstances that are never clear to her till the end of the book, when she's 4 years old. As I said, she goes on to become an interior designer. She marries a man who's loosely actually in the Tiffany circle, becomes involved with Tiffany's daughter, Dorothy Tiffany, who is an important historical figure, who actually became Anna Freud's life partner. So that's the second strand. And the third strand is Grace's story. And Grace, just to remind you, is the 43-year-old niece, great niece of Prudence. And I made a decision that I was going to tell Grace's storyline, starting with Grace's grandfather, and from the moment when he leaves New York, which is essentially when Prudence stops knowing his story. And Randall, who is Grace's grandfather, Prudence's brother, stows away on a train at the age of 14. It's 1923. And he arrives in San Francisco, and he has some kind of Dickensian years working in a florist shop. And he ultimately opens his own florist shop and marries a kind of renegade socialite with whom he has one child, Leo, born in 1948. And Leo comes of age into his own teenage years not long before the Summer of Love in San Francisco, and takes up with a runaway girl from Texas, and the two of them move to Northern California to a commune where they have twins, of which Grace is one. So she's born on a commune in Northern California and ultimately is raised by her grandfather, Prudence's brother. So that's the third strand, and it tells really what has happened in Grace's life. And then they ultimately, as I said, weave together to become the story of this fragmented family.
And that, dear reader, all happened in 280 pages. Let's all reflect on how she accomplished that. I was thinking if you were going to give an elevator pitch, it would have to be like an elevator to, you know, space.
I've never been able to do an elevator pitch for this book because it's just too complicated. Though, I was myself astounded when in the final copy it's only 287 pages.
Right.
And for that I have to credit my wonderful agent and editor who really helped me to get rid of a great deal that was extraneous to the heart of the book, which is really the relationship between Prudence and Grace. So there were many, many more stories that are not even in this book that are now sitting in my computer. We'll see what happens to them.
Well, that's what that was going to be one of my questions, was the original manuscript like, 8,000 pages, and it just feels so compressed and so, you cannot stop paying attention for a single sentence in this book. But it's so beautifully woven. I mean, it's just a masterpiece.
Thank you, Marie. That's very sweet of you.
No, it really is.
One of the challenges of this book, in addition to getting rid of everything that was extraneous to understanding who Prudence is and who Grace is, and once I had that idea in mind, it was painful but easy to figure out what needed to go on the cutting room floor. Mm. What was challenging was the pacing, to make sure, because I go back and forth between these three strands, to make sure that for the reader, when we drop off at each point, it's at a bit of a cliffhanger so that they're eager to return to that story, but also eager to pick up the one that's been left behind. And that did take quite a bit of work to get that pacing right.
Right, because there's a little bit of a mystery element to this where the reader I confess that I did skip ahead once because I was like, I have to know. I can't stand it. So I was like skimming through, seeing where the characters picked up, which is totally, you're not supposed to do that. But there are several little cliffhangers in here where you just, you know, have to know. And then you jump to the other strand. So that was, so at what, I know sort of the origin story of this, which the photograph of this peacock feast, I encourage readers to pick up a copy of the book and look at this photograph is so compelling. So that, I understand, was kind of your door into the book. Kind of talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I've told this origin story in other interviews, but for your listeners who haven't heard it, essentially I wandered by chance in now 12 years ago into an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, one of my favorite places in the entire world. But I did not enter this exhibit with great hopes because it was about Louis C. Tiffany, who I thought very little of at the time. I thought of him in terms of those lamps, which are overused in ice cream parlors across the country, and the stained glass windows, which never particularly sang to me. But once I entered this exhibit, I realized that he was really a great artist and extraordinarily varied in his pursuits and talents. And at the premise of that exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art was that Laurelton Hall, which is the place where Prudence is born, my fictional character Prudence is born, was in fact his masterpiece. And it was this 84-room mansion that he was the architect of, he was the designer of, and he had designed the gardens and the stables. It was an oyster bay on 588 acres, and it was just fantastical. And at the time, the estates in that area were largely reproductions, either of Georgian English manors or English chateau or French chateau. And he instead did this historical hodgepodge. There is a loggia that's based on the Agra Fort in India, and there's a fountain court that's based on the Topkapi Palace, and there's the heating system inside the minaret. So it's very fantastical. And it was there at that exhibit that I saw this photograph that Marie just referred to of the peacock feast. But what really clinched it for me was when I found out who the girls were. There are five girls in that photograph. Three of them are his daughters. And the middle girl in the photograph is Dorothy Tiffany, 3 months before her marriage, when she became Dorothy Burlingham. And once I discovered that this was Dorothy Burlingham, who probably most of your listeners don't know, but anyone who has been a student of psychoanalysis, as I was in the earlier phase of my life, knows that she was a very important figure in the history of psychoanalysis because she was essentially Anna Freud's partner, and she's the person who got the Freuds, one of the people who got the Freuds out of Vienna in 1938. So in any case, once I saw that there were these other connections, then I had to figure out what had happened in that peacock feast and what this estate had been about.
Right. So in terms of real-life historical figures, we have the Freuds, who are kind of not on the page very much. Anna Freud kind of makes an appearance. But,
right.
And we have Tiffany, who very interestingly hardly ever is really on the page, but just sort of overshadows the whole book.
Yes.
And
yes. He doesn't say a word in the book. He actually only appears in one scene when he pokes his head into a room where Prudence's father is working and leaves without saying a word. So he's actually, as you said, just a shadowy figure in the book, not actually in the novel.
It's interesting because I kind of view that as a metaphor for all the research in this book, that it feels so very heavily researched, but all of that research was sort of feels like it was incorporated into your DNA so that there's nothing didactic about it. It just feels like it's absorbed into you and then it leaks out as necessary, but not heavy-handedly, the way sort of Tiffany the figure does as a character, where he's just absorbed into you, but he seeps out onto the whole landscape of this novel throughout it, and it informs all of it. And I imagine the research for this must have been formidable.
Well, the research really was formidable, and I've since talked to other people who write historical fiction. This was my first real venture into it, and I think people do it different ways. Some people research as they go along, and some do a great deal of research at the beginning. I did the research at the beginning because of my hoping that what you just said would be the case, which that it would be like making a pot of tea where you steep the tea and then you take the tea bag out and you're not drinking the leaves, hopefully. So I wanted to feel as though I was steeped in the atmosphere of the eras. There really are a lot of different eras that I pass through, and then that they infuse the sensibility of my characters without having factoids, you know, kind of plunked into the dialogue or the description.
That was really what I wanted to say. It's interesting because the last time we talked about even when you write a short story, and we were talking about Louisa Meets Bear, you said you always have to know the characters. You have to know at least back to a character's grandparent to understand how that character works and how they think. And then I was thinking, because this book was written maybe contemporaneously with Louisa Meets Bear, that you may have had this on the brain, that of course this book is a manifestation of knowing three generations back and how that informs and how this, you know, trauma or whatever kind of carries down through the DNA of a family. And I thought that might be a nice rule for writers to think about, which is you don't just have to mind the character that's in front of you on the page. You have to mind them back a couple of generations to really understand what makes them tick.
Well, I do believe that, and this book actually has four generations because we have Prudence's parents, Bridgie and Eddie, and then we have Prudence and her brother, who are the next generation, and then Leo, who's Grace's father, and then Grace and her brother Garcia. So it's actually four generations. But I wrote an essay for Lit Hub a few months ago about how that also extends to the physical environment. I have to be able to see the houses where my characters are inhabiting. And in this book, Randall, who's Grace's grandfather, I really had to be able to imagine that house, and I had to be able to imagine Prudence's apartment as well. And I had to understand quite a bit about Laurel to the Hall. Now there was an actual estate, and there are books and many photographs to look at. But the others I had to imagine and create.
Right. I would love to get a picture of your. You should post a photo of your office to see what these timelines must look like to keep all of this stuff straight. Talk just a little bit about that, how you manage this much information, this many characters over this time frame. Obviously, I had too much milk for breakfast. And kind of how you keep that straight and kind of what your physical office looks like. Is this all in the computer? Do you have kind of big sheets of butcher paper or something?
You know, I don't have sheets of butcher paper up, but I do have lots of timelines for this book. And now, of course, I'm working on another book, so that's all been put away. but I did have the timeline to refer to. I didn't really have it in front of me as I was writing, because by the time I began to write, as you said, I pretty much internalized it. Sometimes I would go back and check. So one of the, to make sure that the dates jived, and particularly the historical dates, that if I'm talking about Kristallnacht and in Vienna, to make sure that I have the date exactly right for that. So in this particular book, there were the historical dates that I had to keep track for the Tiffany family, the Burlingham family, the Freud family, all of whom were real characters, and I did not want to... I wanted to respect the historical record for all of them about what had happened in their lives. And then superimposed upon that were the chronologies of my fictional characters. So Prudence's life is marching along at the same time that her brother's life is marching along, and they're not in touch. So I had those. I had many, many timelines going at one time.
Right. Unbelievable.
But when I'm actually writing, I don't like to be referring to them.
Okay.
I may go back and check something, but I want to feel as though the scene is evolving within the moment of the scene.
Right, right. Wow. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Lisa Gornick. We are talking about The Peacock Feast. And so I'm curious about, I mean, so much about this novel to me was class struggles. You know, there's so many crosses in class and skipping class. We have, you know, Prudence and her brother who were born to the servants in the Tiffany house. And then we have sort of, you know, jumps in class as Prudence marries somebody kind of outside of her class. And I recall that a little bit in Louisa Meets Bear as well, that you, that this has kind of been on your mind. And I was wondering if you set out with these kind of interesting themes that reverberate in your head, or if they just kind of organically come out and when the novel is done, you say, wow, I must really be interested in issues of class and social, I don't know, social structures and, you know, kind of these constructs in society. Talk a little bit about that, how consciously you deal with your themes.
Well, I didn't set out purposefully to write about class, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it infuses Louisa Meets Bear and actually my other two novels as well. So I just think it's one of those fundamental ideas that is in my mind. I know for some writers, race is the primary lens and paradigm through which they see the world. I think for me, probably the primary paradigms are feminism and psychoanalysis, which has to do with what you're talking about the way generations impact one another, and so that people kind of inherit the unconscious struggles of their parents that they begin to play out. That's another recurring theme through my books. And certainly class and class mobility, now that relates to my own family history of grandparents who came dirt poor from the Ukraine, and the world that I live in now in New York, which is so defined by class, but it also seems so incredibly relevant to our current day, which many people have said is like the Gilded Era again.
Right.
And so when income inequality has really come to the fore,
right,
in the last 25 years here in America.
Ain't that the truth? Yeah. So over the course of the many drafts, how many drafts would you say?
Oh.
Right.
You know, some of this has to do with what one calls a draft. For me, I write from A to Z. I like to write a book beginning in the beginning, and I go right all the way to the end. Now, sometimes things get always things get moved around and things get reordered. But each time I come to the end of a draft, I then print it out, and I like to put it in a notebook and then read it sort of, you know, almost like a book, so I can see and feel how it flows. And I counted pretty close to the end. I had 29 of those printed out drafts.
Yeah, I believe it.
It's a lot of drafts. And then, of course, that doesn't even count, you know, all the past pages you go through with your copy editor and the in-house copy editors and so on. So a lot of drafts. And it's, for me, having the privilege and the pleasure to not have to produce a book every year, which just does not allow one to do that many drafts, a lot of what happens that's really important happens in the last few drafts, when I can begin to see the themes myself and pull the threads slightly to perhaps bring them a little bit more to the surface, so the reader can see them and allow for some reverberations. And I learned a lot of that through Louisa Meets Bear, about seeing how what happens later in a book can go back and be re-experienced by the reader, reflecting back based on what they know later temporally in their own reading process.
Yes, right. Now, does draft one, would you say, bear much relationship to draft 29? Did it change drastically?
You know, I've not reread. I should go back and do that. But I did reread the opening. The opening is very similar. Though it's interesting, I did have the opening. I thought I had the ending, but somewhere maybe 20 drafts in or so, I added the last three pages, which is now the ending. But in the book that I'm working on now, I do have the last sentence, and I would be surprised if that changes.
Interesting.
So, things, you know, one of the things that happens when you're writing a novel is that as a novelist, we change and develop and grow and try to aim for different things with each book. You know, not only does the form of the novel change and the particular book you're working on change, but we also develop and grow and are able to approach our craft differently, which is a great joy.
Yeah. I like this idea of knowing the beginning and the end, and then how you connect the A to Z changes a lot, and the characters can change a lot. But having that vision at the end of the tunnel, where you can at least see the end of the tunnel, is probably pretty helpful, as opposed to just writing into the abyss and who knows what's going to happen to you. You know.
Well, one of the things that has happened as I've learned more about writing the novel is that I'm more and more interested in structure. So I didn't understand my structure till quite a ways in, but once I got it, that I had these three strands that were braiding together, that was a guiding post. And that's quite different from the story, because actually the story evolved a bit and many things were pared out of it. In early drafts, the patient who Grace is treating, Herman, who's sister, Rose, comes to be with him at the end of his life, and that's part of what spurs her to go look up Prudence, because she thinks about how sad it was that her grandfather and her great-aunt had lost touch, and she becomes curious and wants to meet this great-aunt. They were not in early drafts, so that part of the story was added later on, and I don't want to give away things, but you know, there are other things that happened because of her and Rose in Grace's life. And but the structure remained solid and intact through most of the drafts.
Yes, right. Am I remembering a hospice nurse from Louisa Meets Bear? Was there one? No?
No, I don't think so, but there certainly was a psychologist in that.
Yes, sure.
In that, and there were some deaths in that book,
yes,
too.
Right. I had read somewhere in an interview you did that you were thinking about defining more clearly from the outset a goal for the novel that you're working on, rather than discovering it after the novel is written. And we're drawing down on our time, and I want to talk about this for 2 hours. But I kind of wonder what that does to the novel if you set out to know what your goal is before you write it versus letting it kind of flow organically and then saying that really was what it turned out to be about, you know?
Well, I hope I didn't say I had a goal. I think I was, with the novel progress, I'm a bit more aware of the theme of it from the outset. With this book, I don't think I really knew what the themes were till many, many drafts in. And I'm sure that the theme will change in the novel to be, but I have a sense of what the kind of philosophical subject that I'm grappling with. And I hope it will change and evolve, because I agree with you completely that books are organic, and one of the things that I love about structure is that actually that's what allows for freedom. And that probably comes from my training as having been an analyst, where there was a very structured hour, a start and an end point, but what happened in between was completely wild and open and free.
Right.
And that I think should happen in novels too.
I think the great thing about these drafts is that when you erase the draft, it's like a chalkboard. You can still kind of see the lines coming up through. So there, it's still there. Kind of that residual stuff is still there, even if it's not the big thing on the page. But Oh, it's killing me. We're out of time. I have like 100,000 more questions, so we're just going to have to have you back.
Oh, well, talking. Thank you, Marie. I'd love to come back. I love your show, and I just discovered that it's a podcast,
and
I'm going to be following you now.
I love it. And tell people where we can find you. I know there's a ton of interviews about this. I don't want to plug other interviews, but there are a ton of really wonderful other interviews out there about this. When people Google you, they can find some other wonderful information about the book. But
I have an author website, lisagornickauthor.com, and I put all the interviews under the press section for that, and all the essays under writings, absolutely.
Perfect.
Come take a look.
Absolutely will. Lisa Gornick, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Marie.
That was Lisa Gornick. The book is The Peacock Feast. It is out and available and wonderful. We are going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Julie Clark will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can also visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Born and raised in Santa Monica, California, Julie Clark grew up reading books on the beach while everyone else was surfing. She attended college at the University of Pacific and a brief stint working for the athletic department of the University of California, Berkeley. She returned to Santa Monica to teach. Her debut novel, The Ones We Choose, is published by Gallery Books and came out last year. The book has been recently optioned for television by Lionsgate. My huge pleasure to welcome her on, Julie. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. So I should mention for listeners in the area who happened somehow to get tickets to Literary Orange before it sold out in like 5 minutes, that we'll be on a panel together. And
exciting.
Yeah, and the panel is Family Ties, which you will see in a moment why this novel is such a perfect fit for the book Family Ties. So I'm going to let you set the stage for us, for people who somehow have missed the novel for the past year and haven't, they need a little insight into where we are. Kind of set the stage for The Ones We Choose and take us into your world here.
Okay. The Ones We Choose is the story of a single mom, Paige, who is a geneticist and a researcher at a university. And she is studying disengaged fathers. Like, that's sort of the focus of her research, and why some men are good fathers and some aren't. And her research is motivated by the heartbreak that she felt from her own father, who kind of abandoned Paige and her sister when they were young. And so she wants answers to this question. And one of the things that Paige has done in her life is that she's decided that she wanted to be a mom, but she did not want to risk her own children having the kind of heartbreak that she experienced. So she decided to conceive her son via donor. She just wanted to bypass all of the heartbreak that she and her sister experienced. So she did not anticipate some of the issues that might come up. Her son Miles is now 8. He's asking questions about who his father is and why can't he know him. And Paige is having a hard time coming up with answers that will satisfy him. So that's sort of the premise of the book, and we follow Paige and Miles and her family through the discovery and return of Paige's father, and she has to make her peace with him. And so it's a story about motherhood. It's a story about single moms in particular. It's a story about making choices about the things that you want your children to have or things you want to protect them from, and knowing that you can't always do that. You know, as parents, we try to shield our children and make sure that, you know, they have the best path forward. And the truth of the matter is there are always things that come up that you can't predict and you can't protect them. So it's a story about forgiveness and forgiving yourself as well.
Yeah. Tell me about the origin of the novel, like how it began in your mind versus, you know, Did it start with a character? Did it start with an idea? Kind of talk a little bit about what the germ of the novel was.
It started with the idea of I wanted to write about a single mom. I'm a single mom, so I have two boys. So I know that experience very well. But I didn't want to follow the kind of typical single mom stories that you find out on the market where you're single by death, single by divorce. I really wanted to write about what I'm encountering much more in the world, and my single mom friends are people who choose it for themselves, not because of tragedy, not because of heartbreak, but because that's what they want or that's what circumstances have given them, you know? So I wrote about Paige, who was nearing kind of the end of her childbearing years or starting to panic about that. She was not in a relationship. She did not have a partner. And she realized that she wanted to become a mother. And so she did so in a way that was expedient for her. That's kind of who Paige is. She's a scientist. So she likes data. She likes facts. She likes, you know. But I began with the character Paige, and I began with what her core need was to become a mother while at the same time protecting herself.
Yeah.
She's very cautious.
Right, right. So it's interesting. I listened to this book with my daughter, who is almost 18, 17. And so it stimulated all of these questions because I feel like she's one of the first generations where a lot of her peers came to be through reproductive technologies. And so we were able to witness in real time some of the issues that these kids were grappling with as her friends were growing up. You know, there were a good handful of them. And, so it just brought up, it strikes me as a novel that couldn't have been written 30 years ago, of course, and it probably couldn't be written 30 years from now. It's just very timely, issues that I think, you know, our society is just coming around to.
Yeah. And I think with the advent of all the DNA tests that you can do on yourself, the genetic testing that you can do to find out who your family members are and, you know, where your family originated, all of that is so timely right now. People are finding out all kinds of things that they didn't expect to find when they're sending off in one of those kits.
Right.
It's interesting to watch it play out.
Is it not? Yeah. One of her friends just found out, found out who her donor dad was, and you know he's got well over 100 siblings, and
I don't think they let you do that anymore. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff in newspapers and the media about it. You know, for good or for bad, it's an interesting path to take, but it also with it carries great responsibility that our country right now kind of lags behind the rest of the world. There's still the ability to become an anonymous donor, and all the research shows that that's not generally good for kids, and it's not generally good for just anything, because you have no way to know what anyone's medical history is other than what they choose to disclose in the initial donation. So there's very little follow-up. It's a very complicated, as I researched this novel, it's a very complicated kind of industry that I'm hoping will have some more regulations put on it with all of the things coming out in the news about, you know, these fathers that have fathered, you know, hundreds of children, and what that's irresponsible to do, because, you know, when you grow up and you fall in love, you would always have this fear of, like, what if it's my brother? What if it's my sister? You know, and it's a challenge. It's a challenge that is faced by, you know, donor-conceived kids in this way.
Right, right. So let's talk about that, the research process in writing the book. Okay. We'll get down to the nitty-gritty of the writing process and kind of what that looked like. I assume it's a lot of online stuff, but when you felt like you had your arms kind of around it enough to incorporate enough of it into the book but not have it feel sort of didactic to the reader.
Yes, I had to do a lot of research on genetics simply because there's a very strong genetic subplot with this particular book. Paige, my main character, is a geneticist, so she needed to be fluent in science and genetics. But there are these little interstitial chapters in between each narrative chapter that is a little bit of science, a little snapshot of cells or DNA, and it's relevant to the development of the story. And a lot of it is told through Paige's voice, which gives you a little bit more insight into sort of what she's thinking and what her childhood was like and what her feelings are as the book progresses. And that was hard to write because I'm not a scientist. I'm a teacher. I don't know anything about science. I don't know anything about genetics. So I really had to dive deep and learn a lot. So I read a lot. I bought books and I read them. They were well beyond my reading level, if you will. I had to really parse it down into some bite-sized pieces, which I hope I've delivered in the book, and made the science accessible to everybody. And I also worked with a geneticist at Vanderbilt University. When I got far enough along in my research to realize what my character was needing to do, I contacted a geneticist, and he worked back and forth with me for several years.
Oh, wow.
And I bounced ideas off of him and questions off of him and sent him all of my science pages. He looked over all the science in the book to make sure that it was accurate. The last thing I wanted to do was put a book out that didn't have accurate information. So as of publication in 2018, and of course science is changing daily, the science in the book is accurate with the exception of the gene that Paige has discovered inhibits fathers from being checked in with their kids. She has discovered a gene called the oxytocin inhibitor gene, and that is a fictional gene that my friend, my geneticist at Vanderbilt, Dr. West, and I kind of invented between the two of us.
That's great. Yeah, these little chapters before were wonderful, and I thought, you know, it's a wonderful way to add a different texture to the book that informs the narrative but is outside of the narrative, and you're right, gives the reader sort of access to Paige's other life that we, you know, wouldn't kind of tediously have too much access to. I thought that was really wonderful, and I was wondering, you know, as a debut novelist or any novelist, if it was kind of provided you with nice touchstones to organize the book around where it felt like it was more manageable bite-sized chunks that you could tackle. Did it help your structure?
No, it no. didn't. The short answer. I wrote the narrative first, and I had about four of these genetic subchapters. And my editor loved them and said, I want one between every chapter. And I thought, oh, my, what in the world am I going to talk about? But okay. So I just started making a list of all the things that could be related to the story, DNA, cells, genetic, you know, attraction, epigenetic inheritance, all of these things that I came across just in my research on who Paige was and what she was researching herself and what was important to her, and just started writing those. But those chapters came last, and there was a lot of rearranging probably well after the book was sold and into edits. Rearranging, moving those chapters around to make sure that they flowed into the narrative seamlessly.
So. That is so funny because it felt so organic and just like it was always there. I mean, it almost felt like those were there from the beginning, and then, you know, they provided the little touchstones for, okay, here's what the next chapter is going to be. So that's interesting.
I'm glad to hear you say that because that's a big relief, you know, when you're putting something together at your desk alone in your office. You don't always know how it's going to come off.
Right.
So that's good to hear. Thank you.
Right. That is funny. So the book was written over the course of how many years?
I began it in April of 2014, and I sold it to Gallery in April of 2017.
Okay.
So three solid years of drafting, but I took a long, long path. I needed to find a literary agent in that time. There was a lot of non-active writing stuff going on that needed to happen in order for the book to find its home. So I would hope my next book won't take 3 years.
Talk a little bit about that process for our listeners, because I think a lot of people are in that stage of, you know, how do I do that?
I generally read a lot and read the acknowledgments of every book I loved to see what editor worked on it and what agent worked on it. I knew that I wanted to go the traditional route with a big five publisher. And so to do that, you need a literary agent. You need to query the agent with kind of like book jacket copy. And if they're interested, they email back and ask for more pages. And most of those queries end in rejection. I would say 90% of them end in rejection, 98%. It's daunting. It took me about 3 years to get a literary agent. So it's...
How many queries did you send, would you say?
Hard pass. I would say at least 100. Uh-huh. What helped me at the end was I entered the manuscript into a contest called Pitch Wars, which is a curated contest for literary agents to come and make offers. And I was able to work with two published authors to revise and polish my manuscript to be in tip-top shape. And that was invaluable to me. I ended up with many agent offers and was able to really pick from some of the best, I think, in the industry. It was quite a ride at the end there. So,
oh, that's cool. Say the name of the contest again.
Point.
Oh, I'm sorry. Say the name of the contest again. I haven't heard of that.
Pitch Wars. It's run by Brenda Drake. It's mainly young adult, but there is an adult category. She runs it. It just finished up this last February. Used to be running through the summer, like August, September, October, kind of months, but it's a pretty big online contest. It's one of the biggest ones. And so that really pushed my manuscript to the next level. It allowed me to work with writers who had already published books, and that gave me a really good insight into what the edit letter would be like, what it was like working with an editor. Was very similar to working with these authors to polish the manuscript up for the agent round.
That is fantastic. That's fantastic. So talk about sort of the drafts that this went through, and if the original manuscript, you know, first draft, if you went back to read that now, is it shocking how much it changed, or did it pretty much stay the book that you thought it was always going to be?
The themes stayed the same for sure. That my main character, Paige, started with a completely different name and a completely different job. She was a manager of a dog rescue. And then when I realized that this was really a story about your ancestry and your familial origins and your DNA and your biology and how the traumas of your ancestors are actually passed on to you, I realized that I needed Paige to be a geneticist in order to fully flesh out those themes that came a little bit later. But the first draft is absolutely the story of a woman who decided to conceive her son via donor because that to her felt safer.
Right, right. Were there characters in here that gave you particular problems that, you know, you just couldn't access who they were, and talk a little bit about mining them out?
I had a hard time with Paige, my main character. She was very unlikable for a very long time. And I had to soften her way up for the final draft. And she's still a little prickly. People tell me that, you know, there are times when Paige is incredibly frustrating to them. And I intended it to be that way. I didn't want her to be unlikable, but I did want her to be closed off. Mm-hmm. She starts the book very closed off from her boyfriend, Liam, and from her father and from all of the things that could potentially hurt her. And through her friendship with Jackie, who's another character in the book, who she meets, whose son befriends Paige's son, Miles, she starts to learn how to open herself up and make herself vulnerable. And that's really kind of the essence of the book as well, is that it's not just about genetics and family. It's also about the family that you choose for yourself. And Jackie is definitely the character that changed Paige in some very fundamental ways that, you know, we know the best friendships in life can accomplish. That's what they do. They change you forever. Whether they stay in your life or move on out of your life again, you are fundamentally changed by those friendships. And that's also what the book is about.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of writers who say that, you know, they can kind of see shards of themselves in a lot of their characters. And I don't know if, you know, you have this big cast, and if you can kind of see little snippets of either your relationships or your own self, or kind of where you get the material of life to mine and, you know, blow these characters into life. But as you look across the cast of these people, can you kind of see reverberations of, oh, I, you know, he reminds me of him, or this reminds me a lot of me, or kind of where you get the stuff that makes these characters so real?
I think they're all me. And that's sort of how I'm able to get inside their head. I wouldn't say that they're based on people I know necessarily. They're based on experiences of people I know. But really every character in the book is a version of me, from Paige to her sister Rose, to Jackie, to her boyfriend Liam, to her research assistant Bruno. All of these people are different voices that I am at different times in my life and with different people, you know, in different settings, or people that I wish I were, things that I wish I could say. I think I wish I was more like Jackie, so maybe I wrote the friend that I would like to be for others. I wrote the boyfriend that I wish I had in Liam, who, you know, is everybody, all my readers and book clubs and whatnot that I talk to are like, Liam, let's talk about Liam. And I just wrote the perfect man, you know? I just wrote someone who felt real and strong and true and honest, and the kind of person that anybody would kind of be crazy to not let all the way in. But Paige really struggles with that.
Right, right. And you wrote this, it sounds like you're a full-time teacher and a single mom, so finding the time to do this. Good job.
Yeah.
Good job.
I am.
Was this written sort of in the wee hours?
I do. I wake up at 3:45 in the morning, Monday through Friday, and
there
get about 2 hours of writing in every day. It's sort of my work time, and it's hard. The alarm goes off every day. I think, oh, no, I can't. But lots of coffee and the quiet hours. My body is just accustomed to it now, so it's not too bad. I go to bed very early, but I don't really struggle with it anymore. And that allows me to kind of clear my head for my teaching day, which I have to make sure I'm present fully for the students in my classroom and making sure that I'm, you know, doing the very best that I can for them. That's very important. I never want one job to be at the expense of the other job.
Yeah. 3:45, dear listeners, 3:45 is when that's how this gets done every single day.
Well, and that's the truth, is that you can write an entire book in just a couple hours every day. You don't need to work for a full 6-8 hours every day in order to get a book written. You really, really don't. And I can, you know, if you set a goal for, you know, 100 to 1,000 words a day, it's fairly easy to get if you promise yourself you don't have to sit there for more than 2 hours. It can happen.
And you probably should.
I mean, think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a point of diminishing returns after a while of just sitting there. 2 hours, and you have the clock going, and you know it's going to end, so you're motivated. I think that's not a terrible way to do it in any scenario.
Yes, and there are times when there needs to be more time.
Yeah.
So you have to carve out that time on weekends, or you have to carve out that time on vacations. My kids know when my door is closed that unless they're bleeding, they can't disturb me, which they pretty much ignore anyway, and right. come in all the time. And I learned this first as a reader that, you know, my kids can see me reading and I'm in a completely different world, and they'll be screaming, yelling, chasing each other around the house, and I won't really notice. I've learned how to kind of block that out a little bit, which helped when I sat down to write a book, because again, like, I know when there's something really wrong, but it's easy for me to dip in and dip out, which
right.
I don't need to have that silence, that dedicated time, that dedicated space. You know, I can write a few words and then go stir somebody's mac and cheese if that's what they need, and then go back and write a little bit more. So my reading through that really helped teach me how to do that through my writing.
Right. This was a pleasure, and I can't wait to spend Saturday next April 6th with you. This will be wonderful. But sadly, we're out of time.
Yeah.
Julie Clark, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was good to talk to you.
So it was great. That was Julie Clark. The book is The Ones We Choose. That is all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Stay tuned for more awesome music coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.